The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee members. We had left off, I think, on page 6, so I'm going to invite Chancellor Rosenstone back up and welcome him to the committee, and if he'd identify himself for the record. And we were on page 6. It's probably in your save folder. Save folder, and the title of it is Working Together Minnesota's Prosperity FY 2014-2015 Budget Request. And I'm on page 6 with the tuition increases and tuition reduced by. And Chancellor, as you know, this is the week that targets will be announced for our divisions. I'm going to go back to the top section on the tuition increases, which at our last meeting were 3% and 3%. Can you explain to the committee why it's 3% and not 2% or 4%, and what exactly is happening with 3 and 3?
Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Stephen Rosenstone, Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We began in formulating our legislative proposal by identifying the outcomes that we needed to produce during the next biennium. That led to a set of priorities and a shared funding strategy. The funding strategy involves not just state support, but also support from students and fundraising and efficiencies that we produce in the system. So the goal was to try to accomplish the things that we outlined for you at the beginning of last week's session, and then figure out the best funding strategy to produce it, recognizing that there needs to be shared responsibility between our students, Minsk U through its own cuts and efficiencies and fundraising, and from the state of Minnesota. We recognized from the get-go that not everything could be paid for by the state of Minnesota, but it needs to be a shared responsibility, some of it by our students, some of it by us, and some of it from the state.
Chancellor, what happens if it's 2 and 2? What's lost here? I would, if possible, in some specificity.
Chair Pulaski, there will be things that are on our list, from compensation to the investments that we've identified that we've been discussing, that simply would not be able to be done during the biennium.
Are the investments listed below, Chancellor? The internships, the scholarships, the grant aid, are those the investments you're referring to?
The investment, Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, the investments we've been talking about are best summarized on page 2 of the binder. We've been walking through them step by step over the last session. We'll finish today. But on page 2 of the binder, it's a one-page roll-up of the investments that we've been discussing with the committee and that have been there in our proposal. If we're looking at numbers that are less than the $97 million that we've requested, or numbers that are less than 3% tuition increase, we would have to do some triaging of the investments and triaging of our ability to cover 3% compensation during each of the next 2 years of the biennium.
Chancellor Rosenstone, I've said this throughout the course of this session, and now that we're in the week that we're actually going to get targets, I asked the question of President Kaler, and this is probably the appropriate time to ask you. If it's a choice between holding tuition as low as you can hold it and creating new programs, what is your priority?
Chair Pulaski, at the moment, the priority that I'm authorized to represent to this committee is the priorities of the Board of Trustees, who have the authority to bring forward proposals to this legislature. Those priorities at the moment are a 3% tuition increase and the priorities that are contained in the biennial request. If we're looking at a different financial constraints that this committee and the state is facing, I would have to go back to the board and consult with them about how we'd where we'd make the cuts and what would be thrown overboard.
And Chancellor Rosenstone, I'm going to remind you and the trustees, if you do not establish a priority, we will, because it's our fiduciary responsibility to make sure that this money is spent as well as it can be spent. And I think you know the train of thought this committee has had, particularly with respect to tuition increases and debt, and the volatility that that has caused with those individuals that have had to pay the tuition and carry the debt. So I'll be hopeful that before we put the higher ed bill together, we will have a priority, and not everything can be a priority. Those days are long past. We're now rank ordering need and deciding what we can afford in need. Wants off the table. So I'm going to be as blunt as I can. We'll establish it if you don't, and if you don't give us direction, you may be disappointed.
Chair Belowski, members of the committee, I do indeed look forward to that conversation. My response was not that the board won't establish priorities. It's that I need to consult with them before I can share with you what those priorities would be. And I do look forward to that conversation.
Do we have a trustee here today?
No, we do not.
They're beginning to act more and more like the regents, but go ahead, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski, members of the committee. With that, I thought we might just continue on page 7 of the handout you received last time. There's just a couple few slides left to discuss. The third and final priority in the request that the board has put forward is to focus on accelerating completion. Indirectly, of course, accelerated completion means affordability. It also means increasing the number of credentials we're able to produce each year. It's important that we increase retention and completion. We know how to do so, and we're asking for your help in accomplishing that. $8 million in 2014, $4 million in 2015 to lead to a higher number of certificates, diplomas, and degrees, and to move students through in a more timely fashion. We know how to do this, and the places we're asking your help are in two places. First, to deploy predictive analytics, that is, to provide students, faculty, and advisors the means to systematically identify student progress towards completion and to deploy high-impact intervention where necessary. That means early warning systems that do the analytics to identify students that are heading towards trouble. It provides additional targeted intervention by faculty and academic advisors, tutoring, learning communities, intrusive advising, bridge programs, and the like, to ensure that students, when they're heading into trouble, are brought back on track. We have some best practices that are in place in some of our colleges and universities. We'd like to be able to scale them up statewide. The other thing we need to do is make sure we actually have the faculty and staff in place to provide the support to our students so they can complete in a timely fashion. We are facing a tremendous wave of retirements over the next 5 years, and that will increase the competitiveness for talented faculty and staff. The request that the board has put forward calls for a 3% compensation pool in each of the next 2 years. That's not just salary, but rather salary and fringe over the next 2 years. And the strategy we brought forward was that we're asking for help from the state of Minnesota to cover one-third of that compensation pool. One-third would be covered through our own internal efficiencies within MinSCU and our colleges and universities. And we're hoping to be able to rely on one-third of the compensation pool from additional tuition that our students would pay over the next biennium. And the final component of this initiative is to think about growing PSEO and concurrent enrollment. Put differently, if we're able to bring in more students into our colleges and universities who, while they're still in high school, are able to have a semester or two of college-level work for those that are indeed ready for college-level work, through the expansion both of PSEO courses being taken on our colleges and universities and the expansion of college-level courses being offered by high school teachers in the high schools with mentoring and supervision by our faculty, then we're doing several things. One, we're dramatically increasing the efficiency of the way in which state resources are used, using those resources once, not twice. Secondly, more students will graduate high school with some college under their belt, meaning that the total cost of their college education will go down. And finally, it's included as part of a completion strategy because if students are coming in with a semester or more of college credit when they begin, they will, of course, complete their college diploma, certificate, or baccalaureate degree sooner and in a more cost-effective way.
Chancellor, I want to go back up to the first one. Why do we have to pay $12 million extra for you to do something that would appear to be part of your responsibility anyway? So you've got a system office, you have campuses that have administrators and professionals that can do this. Why do we have to pay $12 million extra to do what should be your responsibility from the minute a student steps on that campus?
Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, it is indeed our responsibility. We know how to meet that responsibility, but because of the cuts over the last 4 years, the resources that would have been in place to meet that responsibility are no longer in place. That's why we're asking for your help.
And, Chancellor, I can appreciate it now, but during the entire time the cuts were being done, There was no complaint from Minscu that they couldn't handle everything. And when your predecessor said everything, I assumed it would have meant retention and completion. I still find this one disconcerting, that we have to pay extra money for retention and completion in a system of your size and complexity with two levels of administration, one system-wide and one on each campus. It is part of the problem of higher education and funding that this wasn't done and hasn't been done, and now we have to pay extra so that it might be done. But proceed.
Thank you. On slide 8, we try to summarize for you the funding strategy, which I've alluded to just a few moments ago. We did, from the get-go, recognize the financial constraints that the state of Minnesota confronts, recognizing that everything we needed to do could be on the backs of the taxpayers of Minnesota. And so from the get-go, we put together a three-pronged strategy. Some funds from the state of Minnesota, some funds, though less, from our students through modest tuition increases, and some funds through our own efficiencies and the private fundraising that we would engage in. There, in effect, is a leveraging of the state's investment and a very hefty over 2-to-1 leveraging of the investments that our students would make in their education. And on slide 9...
Excuse me, Chancellor. Representative Winkler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, I have two questions on your slide 7. The $12 million to implement student progress tracking and predictive analytics. The $12 million, how much of that is broken out into sort of an IT spend versus staff training, hiring, or something, you know, whatever else you're planning to do there?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, the lion's share is human beings, but some of it is the technology that we've been piloting on several of our campuses that we would like to deploy in a more systematic way across the system. But it requires human beings both to observe the data, load the data, and most importantly, interact with the students to intervene when they need help.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, is that a IT system that you're going to essentially house at your central office and provide to the campuses? And part of the reason I ask is that I know that there's an eFolio system in place and a GPS life plan that has been used, and it's my understanding that that's being sort of decommissioned at the central office level and maybe distributed to the campuses. I wonder if you could just briefly comment on that.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, our strategy with respect to information technology is to engage the CIOs from our colleges and universities and ask them to devise the best strategy by which a particular software package or program or platform is deployed. In some cases, the shared strategies that we deploy system-wide are not sitting at all in St. Paul. They're sitting on other campuses. So, for example, we've deployed over the last year a strategy by which any employee or student anywhere in the system can log in system-wide to get access to resources that exist on any one of our campuses. The lead team on that is sitting at Winona State University because they're the team that was best able to deploy it on behalf of the entire system. So in this case, we'd also be working with our colleges and universities and getting their counsel about the best strategy for deploying the predictive analytics that exists at the moment only on some of our campuses. From a procurement point of view, working together as a system to get one price, a very good price, as opposed to each of our colleges working independently to bid a contract for a particular system would be a huge financial advantage, which would create an efficiency which would serve the colleges very well.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, jumping down to your expansion of PSEO and concurrent enrollment, I'm particularly of the view that students in high school should be able to get much more access to technical education than they have now, and concurrent enrollment and PSEO are the two ways of doing that. Can you comment on the degree to which you envision this expansion to be for high-achieving students to get a better deal by not having to pay tuition for, you know, baccalaureate-type classes versus technical education? And I think the Irondale example is probably the best example of something that should be replicated. I wonder if you could just expand on that.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, there's actually three different models here. One would be the high-achieving student who's really outstripped what a particular high school might be able to provide, let's say in math or science or languages and the like. The second would be the Irondale example. These are students which are overwhelmingly coming from families that are enjoying federally subsidized lunch program to give you a sense of the demographic. The partnership we have with Anoka Ramsey Community College and Irondale is that approximately 70% of the students graduating from Irondale in 3 years will graduate with an associate's degree in one hand and their high school diploma in another hand. And then you can go up to the Range, for example, and see where the push is really on the technical side of education. We imagine all three of those populations being served, and as this legislature adopted last year, it opened the door to PSEO for technical education for 10th graders who are prepared to begin college-level work. The other dimension here is making sure that we're providing the instruction in the place that makes most sense. If there's a critical mass, as there is in Irondale, it makes perfect sense for that instruction to be provided at the high school campus by a high school teacher. Our role is to simply mentor and help ensure that it's indeed a college-level course. But if you take the high-flying math student or a student in technical education where there isn't a facility in place on that high school campus, we want to make sure that we have a place in our colleges and universities to meet the needs of those students. So it's a little of both.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, as I've talked about concurrent enrollment in PSEO, I have heard from both the K-12 system and from the Minsky system that they lose money on PSEO, presumably because some of the K-12 dollars go to Minsky and you don't get the full boat tuition. How much more can you do in PSEO and concurrent enrollment without new money?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, very little. And let me explain the math to you. The current PSEO bill requires that the university or college providing the PSEO cover the cost of the textbooks for students, covers the cost of any lab or course fees for students. And quite frankly, we're using tuition dollars paid by students who are college-level students enrolled to help cover the cost of those textbooks and lab fees. They're not reimbursed under the current formula. At the case of our universities, and though the lion's share of the PSEO is at our colleges, at our universities, the number of dollars that are transferred under the PSEO formula don't cover the cost of instruction for those students. Finally, there's no dollars in place that pay for our faculty playing the mentoring role that they play in the case of an Irondale type arrangement, and we're currently also using tuition dollars from our students to help cover that. If indeed we want to be able to grow the opportunity for students, all three kinds of students that we've discussed, to get access to higher education, either through PSEO or concurrent enrollment, we are going to need some help to do so. Otherwise, we're continuing to use the precious tuition dollars from our students to help pay the cost of educating the high school students.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, final question. Chancellor, how much do you want per student?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, I don't have in my head the for student rate. Maybe we're going to get it here from Vice Chancellor King with your permission, Chair Pawlowski.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, is $33 per student served.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Chancellor, so if we give you, for every $33 for PSEO we give you, you can take another student?
Okay. Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, clarify that is per credit, and that is the cost that currently is uncovered, not covered, by the resources that travel with the student when he or she moves to us from K-12. So $33 per credit. So roughly put, if a student's taking a three-credit course, the part that is not covered right now is equivalent to $100. The current formula covers the rest.
Final,
Representative Winkler.
Final point, Mr. Chair, Chancellor Rosenstein. So the cheapest thing that we could fund then would be probably a certificate program, something that requires the fewest number of credits for that student.
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, I would think that perhaps a preferable strategy might be to say we will fund up to X number of credits per student, recognizing that for some students a certificate's really not the relevant thing to do. For other students, it might be pre-baccalaureate courses or basic education courses, which might be the relevant thing to do.
Final question. Again, the final question. Mr. Chair, Chancellor, well, they keep bringing in this new information. Is there any limit now on the number of credits that students can get through PSEO or concurrent enrollment?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Winkler, and I may ask for a lifeline from Representative Reinert on this. I do not believe so, except the physical limitations on the amount of time that a student has from when he or she might begin PSEO to complete it. I think in practice, the limit is generally about 2 years worth of credit. And there are some students who will graduate high school who will have 2 years of college credit under the belt when they do so because of the double counting, if you will, of the PSEO course, both towards college credit and towards high school graduation.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski is next.
Thank you,
patiently wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, I'm going to just kind of go along that line of questioning, Representative Winkler, and then I had some other questions. Oh, maybe we'll step back, but to kind of continue along that line, you know, you kind of talked about for PSEO students, MNSCU loses money, essentially. But it seems there are certain institutions that maybe have a greater percentage of PSEO students than other schools. You know, how do those schools in themselves balance that if they have a larger percentage versus other institutions that may have a smaller population of that type of student? I mean, how does that actually work when it's on the field? Like, because I think the numbers from what we went over maybe potentially a month ago were pretty prevalent, I thought.
Chancellor Rosenstock.
Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, those costs are borne by the individual college and university. There are no funds that flow to the system office which are redistributed to cover this, but those funds are paid out of the pocket of that college or university to make up the difference right now.
Okay.
Representative Swazinski.
Okay, thank you. That's kind of what I wanted to know just in case. All right, and then going back to that top of the slide, we've got the $12 million to implement a student progress tracking. Really, is this kind of a reinventing the wheel? Is this a brand new program? Other states that have potentially put this in place, what kind of results have they seen? You know, oftentimes people come to us and say, well, if you put a dollar in, it's going to save us at $4 here or something like that. Is there some of that data out there that could, you know, kind of sell that portion of your budget?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, predictive analytics are producing between 10 and 15% boosts in retention and completion, which is very effective. The beauty of our system is that we can run several different experiments simultaneously and learn the best practices. We also have the benefit of looking at the best practices in other states. We're not trying to home grow it or make it up ourselves, but rather find the one that seems to work the best and deploy it statewide. But we're looking in the ballpark of 10 to 15% boosts in completion as a result of this investment.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that would be about, is your assertion that that would be a 10 to 15% cost savings as well? Or just, you know, from a cost perspective versus, you know, office completion is our large goal of ours, but from a cost perspective, what kind of savings does that cost? Is that bore by taxpayers, the students, timing? How would you prescribe that? Yes.
Chancellor Rosens.
Representative Pulaski, members of the committee, the largest savings, I believe, goes to the student, because he or she is completing in a more timely fashion and beginning a much higher paid wage-paying job earlier in his or her career rather than the opportunity costs of being in college for a longer period of time. In the long run, if we can improve, if you will, the throughput in higher education, then the seats in any one institution are being held less time, meaning we can serve more students with the fixed resources. I can't give you the dollar calculation today. We could try to make an estimate for you. But the real focus here is on serving students better and getting them out into the workforce faster. There will probably be some gain of efficiency for the institution through this improved throughput.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenstone, just kind of one last question on the PSEO side of things. We talked about 38% of students currently are looking at the need for remedial courses. If we were to break that out when it comes to PSEO students, the amount of classes that those students are taking, are they remedial in any, I mean, are they taking a remedial course, or are they taking kind of a general coursework that is more predictable for a specific degree? How would you gauge some of those things? So if we are having 38% of remedial courses, obviously, if you've got a large percentage of students that are PSEO students on your campus, it's people that already have graduated. So it's a kind of almost compounds that issue, it seems like. But
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Representative Pawlowski, members of the committee, those that come to take PSEO courses are not taking developmental or remedial courses. They're taking real-life college-level courses. One of the beauties of this alignment bill that Representative Breinhardt's been shepherding is that if we're able to align the assessment that's used in high school with the assessment that we use in college, we're going to be able to give better information earlier on to students, families, teachers, and schools about whether students are on track to higher education. If they are on track, we want to be able to serve them in higher education when they're ready to begin college-level courses. If they're not on track, we first need that information, and secondly, we need to find a way to get that developmental education back into high school to, in effect, get them on track. Our goal from this alignment bill that's under consideration is that more and more students will come to college prepared for college-level work. That's the goal of the alignment. But PSEO is not a way around that. The students that come for PSEO are prepared for college-level classes and are taking college-level courses when they arrive.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Chancellor Rosenthal. How do you say that again?
Rosenstone.
Stone. Yeah, I'm sorry. Names are my weakness, okay?
Nope.
As long as we're discussing this budget request, just one of the things that I met with a private for-profit college today in my office, and they actually reduced tuition 24%. And they don't get any direct appropriations. Of course, they do still get into the, the appropriate or the student grants and those types. You know, they get the other type of student aid that way. But one of the things that occurred to me after visiting with them is they tend to focus in a certain area, okay, of education. And my question is there any merit in the thought that rather than and I'm not again, I'm new to this committee, and I need to learn a lot. Is there any merit to the idea that rather than each college trying to be all things to all people, that you have a focus on each college campus for a certain area and therefore avoid duplication and repetition within the system? Now, maybe it's already doing that. I'm just not aware of that. But I just got thinking after I talked with them that they seem to be able to operate pretty efficiently, but they have a narrow scope of primary focus in what they offer. They're not trying to be all things to all people. And with that type of an approach, and I know, if I remember right, you said a report's coming out in June that's going to help you decide how to create more efficiencies or streamline things. But anyway, I hope you get the idea of what I'm trying to ask, Chancellor Rosenthal, or Rosenstone.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Gruenhagen, a couple observations. First, I don't know the name of the for-profit you met with, but I don't believe that they've reduced their tuition down to $4,800, which is the average tuition at our colleges. And even if you add in the proportion of our costs which are covered by the state of Minnesota, I suspect that our tuition and state support is still substantially, maybe one-half the total account that's being charged to students who are attending that for-profit. Secondly, there are very critical areas of education that the for-profits don't get into. They don't get into mechatronics. Mm-hmm. They don't get into heavy equipment manufacturing. They don't get into all the things that have huge investments necessary to deliver the equipment, the facility, and the training necessary for those programs. They try to go after the very low-cost, high-return programs, and we simply will not have some of the programs we need and some of the workers trained we need if we don't have the investment that's made in our public colleges and universities. The final point is that there are centers of gravity in all of our colleges and universities. Indeed, if you look through the spiral book, you'll see for each college and university what their key programs are. So I think if you were to compare, for example, Normandale, a community college here in the metro, to Alexandria Technical College, they're quite different beasts. And that's in part because of the specialization, the demand of manufacturing industry in central Minnesota. The other thing I think that we've got to constantly keep in mind is the size of our state and the nature of our students. Our average student is 26 years old. he or she is working, often has a family, might have a job, and they're retraining for their new career. And the stereotype of a student being 19 years old, picking up her things, throwing them in the back of the car, driving 200 miles, moving into a dormitory, and paying the tuition and dormitory fees necessary to sustain that kind of education, that's not the education that's the lion's share of the students we're serving. And so I think there has to be a balance between the right match of programs to where the needs are and a balance to what the needs are in greater Minnesota, where the distances are quite large. We have many students that are commuting 50, 60 miles a day to get to their classes. Asking them to commute 200 or 300 miles a day is just impractical. So getting the right balance, as you suggest, between the right match of programs with the needs of the students and the workforce needs of Minnesota is indeed the right question.
Representative Grunhagen.
You answered that question very well, Chancellor Rosenstone. appreciate the response. Thank you.
All right. Proceed.
Well, we're nearing the end. On page 9, I've tried to lay out for you the details of the matching funds. The $33 million in that chart is comprised of $21 million in proposed matching funds for the leverage equipment program and $12 million in matching funds for the internships. The $64 million on the second line is comprised of $44 million of our own efficiencies and $20 million in private scholarships that we're committed to raising. And then on slide 10, we give you the detailed...
Chancellor, 1 second. At the top, you would be raising those funds over 2014, 2015, so we would expect to see those funds generated within that fiscal year. Is that correct?
Chair Pawlowski, that's correct. Moreover, in our proposal, we identify benchmarks that we will hit in the first year of the biennium, which would be conditional upon the release of funds in the second year of the biennium. So yes, indeed, over the course of the biennium.
Chancellor, you had a modest proposal in tuition. What if you were given a modest proposal in accountability and it went something like this? No new program could be presented to the legislature until you actually proved its effectiveness for one fiscal year. So you, with the immense resources at your disposal, and this would apply as best we could to the University of Minnesota, would have to actually run the program for one fiscal year, come to us and say, we did this with one-time money, here is the result, now we're going to need your help to sustain it.
Chair Pawlowski, that's precisely what we did with the leveraged equipment program. The legislature allocated, I think it was $457,000 in the last session. We ran that program, and we can give you the detailed results of its success.
Chancellor, I don't think you quite understand my modest accountability proposal. We would give you nothing. You would say you would run it for one fiscal year on your own dime, internalizing what it would take to run it. I would agree it's probably one-time money. Then you would come to us and say, this program works and here's how it works. We've seen over the course of 10 hearings here between your system and the U, systems of immense resources, reserves when the states had none, the ability to raise tuition when we did not have the ability to raise any new revenue here. So that type of a proposal, I think, would have two benefits. The first would be it would stop this succession of coming up to the Hill every 2 years with a cascade of new programs that you may or may not be able to sell. It would also then prove the validity of those programs when you propose them to the legislature. You would have a track record. You would be able to say the program actually works. We did it as best we could with one-time money. To continue it, we need a base adjustment.
Chair Pawlowski, I understand, and that's what we did with the predictive analytics on several of our college campuses. I tried to explain how successful those pilot programs have been, and we're bringing the results of those pilot programs to you with a proposal that you help us scale it up so they'd be deployed across the entire system.
Well, Chancellor, I'm slightly skeptical that we're on the same page here, but I'm glad at least we're agreeing that you have the capacity to do this on your own, and that I think with a more focused presentation, you might win more often with these programs than you'd lose. But we're going to be under very tight fiscal constraints again, very tight. And we have seen the core problem of tuition and debt. So I hope that you would entertain, as we have entertained your somewhat modest tuition proposals, perhaps modest accountability proposals. Okay, proceed.
Chair Pawlowski, in each of the elements of our proposal, we've provided accountability metrics that we're prepared to hit in the first year of the biennium as a condition for the release of funds in the second year of the biennium. So I think we might have a further discussion about what those metrics might be, but we have led with an assumption that metrics would be built in, and we're very comfortable being held to accountability metrics as well. On page 10, we provide the details of the request broken down for each of the elements. On an FYE student basis adjusted for inflation, if our request were funded, it would still leave us 42% below where we were with state funding per student in 2000. If the request were funded, the FY215 general fund budget would be 37% state, 56% tuition, and 7% from miscellaneous general revenue income. And compared to 2013, the request we have before you would represent a 1% increase in the share of the general fund budget that's covered by the state of Minnesota. On slide 13, we provide again a reminder, slide 11, we provide again a reminder of what the three priorities are. And in closing, I would like to emphasize that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are a tremendous state resource, a resource that needs your support and that delivers an outstanding return on investment. The data that we have shared with you have shown the longstanding commitment of our trustees and presidents and system leadership to control costs and protect access and affordability. By any measure, MNSCU has been on a steady trajectory of reduced administrative overhead and increased efficiency. Through cost reduction, efficiencies, reallocations, salary freezes, layoffs, and program closures, we met 58% of the challenge that came from the historic cuts in state support. Our students and their families did their part, covering the remaining 42% through tuition increases. Faculty productivity is up over 12%. The system office budget is 24% smaller than it was 4 years ago. There are fewer administrators than there were a decade ago. Administrators comprise only 3% of total employee headcount. The real cost of educating a MNSCU student is down 12.5% over the last decade. And today, MNSCU is the 40th lowest out of 50 comparable state systems in the U.S. in overall administrative spending per student. These are real accomplishments, but we are not resting, and we are prepared, as you saw in our proposal, to deliver an additional $44 million in efficiencies over the next biennium to help hold down tuition, improve quality, and provide pay increases to our faculty and staff. It is the outstanding work of our faculty, staff, and academic leaders that has enabled us to maintain by significant margins our position as Minnesota's most affordable, highest value higher education option. Like you, we are very concerned about student debt, but the fact remains that compared to the state's other higher education options, much higher percentages of MNSCU students graduate with no debt. And those who do graduate with debt have significantly less debt than graduates from other colleges and universities in Minnesota. Now, we've had very thoughtful exchanges, I think, over the last several weeks during our time together. And I think there can be no doubt that every member of this committee is committed to advancing, as we are, the competitiveness of Minnesota's workforce, to increasing access and affordability, and to accelerating completion. In the face of a 45% reduction in state support per MNSCU student since 2000, we have worked diligently to try to balance affordability with quality and to balance it with our ability to deliver graduates with the skills that Minnesota businesses, industries, and communities need to succeed. Achieving the right balance is the challenge before this committee. In order to build the world's best workforce and a strong Minnesota economy, we must invest in the quality of the education that our colleges and universities provide. We will make progress towards building the world's best workforce if students are trained on state-of-the-art equipment and technology, and we make investments in proven strategies to increase retention and completion. We will make progress if we equip our faculty with the tools necessary for student success and collaborative work in a networked world, and if we have the resources needed to attract and retain talented faculty, academic advisors, and technology specialists. And we will make progress in building the world's best workforce if we make the investments needed to deliver more graduates with credentials in high-growth professions like health and life sciences, advanced manufacturing, and energy. Every one of you will play an important role in deciding whether this is the year that the state of Minnesota starts reinvesting in Minnesota State colleges and universities and in the quality of the education we provide our students. The decision you make will affect the quality of the entrepreneurs, accountants, teachers, construction workers, nurses, and mechanics we graduate. It will affect the quality of the education we provide the 17,000 firefighters and first responders we train every year. It will affect how we're able to keep the 120,000 workers we serve each year in our customized training programs on the leading edge of their professions. Your decisions will affect the quality of the education we provide the over 26,000 PSEO students and 10,000 veterans we serve each year. And the decision you make will affect the quality of the 42,000 certificates, diplomas, and degrees we award each year, and how well our graduates will be prepared for the critical jobs that need to be filled in Minnesota. Your decision will affect the 47 communities around the state that depend on our colleges and universities for their economic vitality. Our colleges and universities serve more students of color, more students from families of modest financial means, and more first-generation students than all of Minnesota's other higher education institutions combined. And I am deeply concerned about the quality of the education that these students receive and whether our faculty will have the tools they need to ensure the success of these students. I close my testimony with precisely where I began, with testimony from state economist Tom Stinson. He stated, in quotes, "Minnesota's been very successful. Education has been a key contributor to the state's success. But a portfolio, not a single program, a portfolio of world-class workforce development and education programs will be essential if we're going to continue to be as successful as we want to be. Our proposal is not about helping just a few. It is about serving more than 430,000 students every year. It's about serving communities and businesses and families throughout our state. These are the people who are depending on us to continue to deliver cost-effective, quality education. These are the people who are depending on you to prioritize investment in our human capital and higher education. They are depending on you to help us meet the challenge of balancing access and affordability with the investments necessary to provide the quality education required for Minnesota to have the best workforce in the world. I am confident that by working together, we can meet this challenge and fulfill the high expectations that Minnesotans have rightly entrusted all of us to deliver." With that, Chair Pawlowski, I thank you and members of your committee for the opportunity to spend the time we've spent together over the last 4 weeks.
Chancellor, thank you for being generous with your time and also with the information. We have kept the information, and we are going to use it extensively over the next 2 weeks. I hope you also understand that tomorrow, for the first time in a very long time, you are going to see our commitment to higher education. But our commitment doesn't stand with us going back to the trustees and asking for permission to make a statement. In order to do what you're going to see in the budget tomorrow, revenue is going to have to be raised, significant revenue, for the first time in a very long time in this state. We can either be tax and spend or we can be tax and fix. As I said earlier in your presentation, we have had to rank order need and then decide which of those needs is the most important to be able to sustain in this state. I'd asked you earlier about tuition, what your priorities were. I hope you do go back to the trustees, and the trustees can, or whoever represents the trustees, if it isn't you, tell us what those priorities are, given the narrowness of what we're going to have for resources starting tomorrow. I thank you. You've been outstanding in taking some tough questions, providing information, but the difficulty starts tomorrow, and the choices tomorrow will be real. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Members, next on the agenda is House File 437. Members, this is the governor's budget bill for higher education. This was the first of the governor's bills. This is before recent changes. I introduced the bill at the request of the governor, but it's not my bill. This is the governor's bill, and out of deference to the governor, we're going to have Director Pogemiller present it to us, and I hope those areas that have changed with the recent modifications in the governor's budget, Director Pogemiller will point out to us up and down and what priorities have changed. So the bill, although it's in your packet, and Ms. Grimes is going to get something up for us. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Larry Pogemiller, the Director of the Office of Higher Ed. And this is Trish Grimes, who's our staff person in charge of legislative relations. Mr. Chairman, this is the governor's budget, and we will try to point out the key features for you. The first chart I just want to put up is try to give you a sense of the governor's thinking.
Hang on one second, Director Pogemiller. I think folks are going to have their hands on this one. These screens, while I know we're... I think we're getting it right now. While we may be able to see them when we crank our heads, that screen, I don't think, oh, maybe Representative Norris does because his eyes are so sharp from hunting. But
I just got no glasses, Mr. Chair.
So you're zeroed right in.
I was just going to point out, if I could,
yes,
the price of the big 50-inch flat screens really come down. So maybe we could improve our system a little bit.
You know, Representative Norris, my grandson has an 82-inch high-definition television that his family got about a month ago, and you can see that from two blocks away.
82.
Yes. His father got it for him, and that's I lost that argument.
Wow, how old is he?
Five.
Hey, we look good on that size, I bet.
So,
okay, Director Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just briefly, this slide gives you a sense of the governor's thinking on his entire investment in education. And he views it as a lifelong process, one that's iterative more and more for people. More and more people are no longer just finishing post-secondary degree and then they're done. So this graphic tries to show what his general thinking is. And obviously, since education is the area where he's made the largest investment in his budget, he wants you to know that it's a... across ages. And so he's made an early childhood investment, all day K and scholarships. He's made a formula increase, special ed, teacher evaluation, centers for excellence. And then in higher ed, affordable access through the state grant in an attempt to reduce debt and increase attainment. So both state grant and tuition control. And as you just heard from the chancellor, some workforce issues related to internships and apprenticeships and equipment. And then finally at the university, research and innovation. Going specifically then, his thinking is that it should be a balanced approach and between direct student aid, and this one slide is not in the packet. So he views it as a balanced approach between direct student aid and institutional support to the public institutions, MNSCU and the U of M.
Director Pogemiller, I don't think I've ever seen a balance with three ways to balance before. That's tricky. Just so you know.
Well, I think...
Director Pogemiller.
Well, assayers do this all the time, Mr. Chairman.
You're going to have to sing a pretty good song to get that to balance, but okay. Tune it up.
So, now going specific to the governor's budget, it's a $262 million investment in higher ed in post-secondary education. And the bulk of it is the 80-80-80, $80 million to MNSCU, $80 million to University of Minnesota, and $80 million to need-based aid. In addition, there is $2.4 million For deferred action status, there will be a slide on these smaller items later in the presentation.
Director Bogan, stay here for a second. How was this arrived at? Why is it 80, 80, 80 and not any other series of numbers?
Mr. Chairman.
This seems rather arbitrary, but I'm sure there was a great deal of thought put in it. So,
Director Mr. Bogan. Chairman, since this is a governor's decision, what I can tell you is that I think he believes in a balanced approach between institutional aid and direct aid to students. And once he decided, I'm guessing, once he decided what the total amount of money he had available, he believed a balanced approach for that was this 80-80-80. I don't believe he would call it arbitrary. I think he would think it was strategic in terms of the balance between direct aid to institutions and direct aid to students.
Director Pogemiller, as the governor's budget stands now with the changes he made in revenue, how much revenue does he raise to support this now?
He raises the revenue necessary to support this $262 million investment in post-secondary education.
But how much is the totality of that revenue?
Oh, what? $1.8 billion, apparently.
Okay. I ask that because that's a key number coming into play tomorrow. I'm not advocating that's the number we'll see
Understood.
Tomorrow, but to do this, this is what the governor has raised.
I believe, right. Yes. And, again, to point out of all the areas of a new investment, post-secondary education is the largest percentage increase of any other part of the budget, including K-12.
Can you tell us when was the last time an increase like this was done for higher education?
It's been a while, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I would think...
Ms. Grimes, do you know?
Maybe in the 90s. Mr. Chairman,
I don't know about the 90s. It's been a while.
In the late 90s, there were some years when the economy was expanding rather fast, and I believe there were some increases, but I don't believe they were this high, and I know they were not this high for the state grant program.
Ms. Grimes, I don't think the state grant program has ever seen this type of a split before. This is really unique. But I appreciate the late 90s. I recall them fondly, particularly chairing a certain committee.
Mr. Chairman, we'll do a chart on
that.
We'll pull up some data. We'll try to figure out the direct question with regards to post-secondary in general. Okay. What we can tell you is that the state grant, this is the largest dollar increase and percentage increase in 25 years, largest dollar increase ever in the state grant program.
Director Bogman, I think you're correct there. This is unique. We haven't seen anything quite like this in the grant program.
And there is a slide on these four items I'm going to mention now that are later, but it's deferred action status, which is direct student aid of $2.4 million on top of that $80 million. There's American Indian Scholarship increase of $3 million, which will eliminate the roughly 500 student waiting list for American Indian Scholarships. There is $1.7 million in SLEDS funding, State Longitudinal Educational Data System funding, which is roughly sustaining it with a modest $600,000 investment in enhancing it. And then finally, tuition reciprocity. There's a $15 million investment in tuition reciprocity. And as will be described later, that number is increasing because of the interaction of Minnesota students with North Dakota.
Director Pogemiller, how much for the SLEDs?
$1.7 million.
And Director Pogemiller, has the SLEDs always been in higher ed?
It has not. Mr. Chairman, this is the first time there is a state appropriation being requested. The statewide longitudinal educational data system, SLEDS, was built with a federal grant that was given to the K-12, to the MDE.
Yep.
And the partners in the development of that were Office of Higher Ed and the higher ed institutions in the state, K-12 institutions, and DEED. And there was a decision made internally within the executive branch to allow the sustainability funding for that to be in the higher ed budget and to make the Office of Higher Education the face of the longitudinal data system.
And as we go through this, if there are changes in any of these numbers as a result, or is the governor keeping all of this the way it is under the 1.8?
It is all the same except for an increase in reciprocity.
Right.
This is his original budget with an increase in reciprocity because of new projections based on the North Dakota experience.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair. Director Pogemiller, just kind of going back to the American Indian Scholarship Just kind of want to just visit a little bit about, for a moment or two, just about that. I just did the quick math, and that's approximately $6,000 per student. And if you got 500 people on the waiting list, you got $3 million. You know, how does that work exactly? What does that accomplish? Because I know that was, you know, when we went through the numbers earlier today, Mr. Chair, that was some of the smallest people that were actually graduating, I think 18% of the population or 14% of the population. Kind of how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're exactly right. This is the least attaining group cohort in Minnesota of students. And the American Indian Scholarship has been in place separately as a fund for...
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Grimes?
I believe it's since 1959.
Since 1959, apparently. And this is a scholarship or grant on top of state financial aid. So this is a unique situation for this population or cohort of students. And currently, we put out, I think it's about 500 grants per year. And this would eliminate the additional 500, roughly, that have applied and were not able to get this grant. And the purpose is to try to eliminate that waiting list and get as much attainment as possible. And here we're only, our hope would be, frankly, that if we can eliminate this, the waiting list of 500, that the list will grow again. Because then you'll have more students who see that it's attainable, it's possible. And that would be good in this population, which is the lowest attaining group in the state.
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Grimes?
I could just briefly add, the $3 million is $1.5 million each year.
Yes.
And the average award is $3,200 a student. The maximum award is $4,000 a student a year.
Ms. Grimes, are all your numbers over the biennium? I assume they are, right?
Yes.
So we're not looking at, and if they're not, if they're one time, please tell us.
These are all biennial permanent numbers.
All right.
Yes.
If there's a change, though, let us know.
So then, Mr. Chairman, just briefly, you've heard the MNSCU request. The governor is suggesting out of the MNSCU request that $80 million, or over 80% of the MNSCU request, be adopted as the governor's recommendation. And that would be $12 million for the internships, apprenticeships, $26 million for the leveraged equipment, $8 million for faculty-driven innovations, and $34 million for faculty and staff retention. So again, that's roughly, I think it's 82%, if I'm not mistaken, of the MNSCU request. At the University of Minnesota, the governor's again suggesting $80 million, which is roughly 80% of the university's request. And in that area, he's suggesting $36 million for the research for the four areas, neuromodulation, robotics, food supply, and conserving the environment. And that's $18 million here for $36 million. And then $42.6 million for tuition relief, or basically freezing tuition over the biennium. And then finally, he's supporting the university's request for $1.4 million. And I believe that's in the second year for the health care loan forgiveness. Mr. Chairman, on the state grant then, the last point before I turn it over to staff. The $80 million request will expand eligibility to over 5,000 additional students, including 2,000 students in the middle income range, with middle income being defined as $60,000 to $120,000. And it would increase awards for every recipient. That will be 100,000 students, and with an average increase of $300 over that 100,000 students, but some getting increases as large as $1,450. And, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to staff.
Director Pogemiller, before you leave.
I'll stick around, Mr. Chairman.
Well, but before you leave on this, you've got three components here. You've got MNSCU, the U, and the grant program, which the governor has split evenly. And his resources are the largest we've seen, perhaps historically, in Minnesota. If our resources are significantly less, tell me what the governor's priorities are.
Mr. Chairman, what I can tell you is he believes it should be a balanced approach between institutional support and state and financial and direct support to students, and I think he will be agitating to get your level of funding up to his level.
Director Pogue, he can agitate all he wants, but you need 68 votes, and that level of agitation may be beyond his control. So let's go with this question. assuming that the resources here are significantly less, what's the governor's priority?
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak for him. I don't think he, I think he believes that, I think he hopes that the House and Senate will come close to his level of funding.
Well,
but, Mr. Chairman, if not,
Director Pogemiller,
once you put your targets out, if you, I will directly ask him, at that target level, Governor, where would you like to go?
All right. You'll find that tomorrow. Thank you.
Have I done my pages? Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Meredith Fergus, who is our staff
person on the State Financial Aid.
Please
identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm a policy analyst for the Office of Higher Education. So my purpose today is to kind of walk through the rationale for the state grant parameter changes recommended by the governor's office. As Director Pogemiller stated, the $80 million investment for the state grant program is focused on three changes. The first is to set the tuition fee maximum to the highest resident tuition rate at Minnesota public institutions. So that would be $13,526 at the University of Minnesota and $5,865 for fiscal year 14 and $6,040 for fiscal year 15, which is Dakota County Technical College. The second parameter would be to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance from $7,000 to $8,300, which is approximate the federal poverty level for a single person, as well as to raise the student share to 50% back to its original student share. The rationale for these three changes actually come from a discussion that we've had within our office for many, many years. And what we refer to it as is the unrecognized price problem. When the living and miscellaneous expense allowance and the tuition fee maximums in state law do not equal the actual charges that students pay, then what you have is the resulting costs are 100% covered by the student and the family. So for that $3,000 gap that exists between the tuition fee maximum and the University of Minnesota, rather than it being split 54% family and taxpayers and 46% students, as we have under Design for Shared Responsibility, it is assessed 100% to the students and the families with no taxpayer support. That requires that students must rely on additional student loans, parent loans, and hours of work to cover those additional costs. If we were to include those prices within the state grant program, then we could actually target additional grant dollars to the students, the lowest income students first, and begin to actually distribute those prices as the program originally intended. So we also experienced that problem on the living and miscellaneous expense side when the $7,000 maximum that we have now is about $1,300 less than the poverty level for a single person. So referring back to our typical charts we have for the program, what we have here is an example from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and you can see that very top bar is about $4,388. So it's $3,038 from the gap in tuition fee coverage and $1,300 from the gap in living and miscellaneous expense coverage. That $4,388 must be covered 100% by the students unless you raise those parameters. So that is one of the rationales for the governor's recommendation. We have the same problem at Dakota County Technical College in that the gap, while it is only on the currently the living and miscellaneous expenses, starting in fiscal year 14, that light blue bar at the very top will begin to increase as Dakota County's tuition exceeds the two-year tuition fee maximum. So that light blue bar of implicit student and family responsibility will begin to grow as the program moves over time. So our goal was to eliminate that problem not only in fiscal years 14 and 15, but moving forward and allow you to establish some sort of benchmarks for which the problem would not occur. So
Ms. Fergus, one question. At what level, you're achieving this at $80 million. When do you significantly stop achieving that? At what point? You're moving this at $80 million, all right? So how much does it take not to move this, if it's 40 or 20 or what happens in the grant program?
Mr. Chair, are you asking could we still move it at a lower target?
That's what I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, what you would do is there's a couple of ways to do it, and we've had these discussions as well internally. You could benchmark it and move that benchmark up over time in a progressive manner, and that's what the federal government has done in terms of Pell Grants and inflation. They just inflation adjust them now. In terms of the gap in tuition fees, is a little more problematic in that the tuition fees is set by the University of Minnesota or the MINSQ system, Dakota County, and so those tend to be a little harder to benchmark in advance. But at least on the living and miscellaneous expense side, you could strategically decide to step that up over a course of a number of years.
I would suggest you start taking a look at examples that are significantly less than $80 million, significantly less. And what type of a solution would it be if it drops so low that it wouldn't be worth the investment?
Mr. Chair, we're happy to do that.
I would not say happy. I think you're going to have to. All right. Thank you.
The unrecognized price problem actually has one pretty dramatic impact, is that if you were to include those tuition fee and LME parameters within the design for shared responsibility, you can target additional grant dollars at low-income students in order to help cover rising costs. When it's outside of the grant program and is stated as just an implicit responsibility to all students, then it actually is placed upon all students, lower income, middle income, and upper income, without any sort of assessment of family resources to actually pay those costs. And so that actually kind of disrupts the equity within the state grant program in assessing families by income. In addition, we also feel that once you actually meet the larger parameters for tuition fees and living expenses, then you can actually realistically assess how students pay for higher education expenses. What portion of the assigned student responsibility can be covered through federal student loans? Or do students need to take out additional loans? How many hours per week does the average student need to work to cover their educational payment responsibility? Is the number of hours too high? Can we adjust that in some manner? Once we begin to have the actual costs recognized, then we can actually strategically look at how students are paying and try to balance the program even more so. So this slide simply summarizes the increase in tuition fee maximums. As I stated before, the current gap is $3,038. The state grant model does incorporate tuition fee increases for MINSQ students, so those increases are automatically distributed via the payment assignments, and so 54% of that increase is covered. We have only limited increases in tuition fee coverage for the University of Minnesota since 2008. If we were to go back historically and limit MINSQ students to the same tuition fee increases within the grant program that the University of Minnesota students were limited to, we would actually reduce current spending by $19 million. That is essentially the cost of automatic tuition fee increases to MINSQ students over the last 5 years. In addition, the way the parameters are set is that future tuition fee increases at MINSQ institutions are automatically covered within the state grant program. University of Minnesota students do not have that same luxury. The result is that once you look at what students actually have to pay, MINSQ students pay 46% of the recognized price of attendance. University of Minnesota students now pay 54% or 53.9% of the recognized price of attendance, not the 46% that we tend to believe is in state statute. And that 53% will continue to rise as long as the university's tuition is over your tuition fee maximum. In addition, you will see Dakota County Technical College begin to see an increase in that ASR as well as they move above the tuition fee maximum. In terms of the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, we benchmark that to federal poverty level guidelines for 9 months for a single person. The other benchmark we have is the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is actual diary data on how students 18 to 24-year-olds who are enrolled in college spend their resources, and they average nine-month expenses of $12,869.
So the governor's rec goes to...
Director Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, the governor's rec goes to the $8,300.
Okay.
The final parameter change that the governor recommended was to increase the student share. By returning the student share to 50%, we ensure program equity in the payment assignments as originally intended. It also places the program on a sustainable long-term path for funding students. It also allows us to redistribute that $80 million of limited resources in a manner that does benefit all students. So in terms of what happened, this data is a single year data. This is fiscal year 15. And what you see by sector and then below by income are the number of current state grant recipients who would receive larger grants and the number of students who apply for a state grant but do not currently receive one under current parameters who would receive a new grant for fiscal year 15. As you can see, a large number of students at MinSCU do receive new grants. And in addition, a large number of students at the lower incomes, approximately less than $10,000 and between $10,000 and $20,000, do receive new grants as well. In terms of the time trend for state grants, what the governor's recommendation proposes is to return state grant funding to that average of just over $1,900 as it was in fiscal year 2007, the last time we were at that level. And in addition, it will add approximately 4,000 to 5,000 new recipients each year. The fiscal year 13 number, the green bar there, actually represents a temporary increase we made to the living and miscellaneous expense allowance for this year to spend some unspent funds. In terms of income distribution, the green portion represents those students who would receive larger grants, and the blue represents the new recipients. As you can see, we do add new recipients across the income threshold. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, these are those additional items that are in the governor's budget that are not part of the 80-80-80.
Director Pogamil, I want to go down to the interstate tuition reciprocity. What flexibility do you have on that $15 million? How much of it do you need and when?
Mr. Chairman, the governor's rec both fulfills a $2.4 million shortfall for this current biennium, a deficiency, and then fills the projected amount under our current reciprocity agreement with North Dakota for the next biennium. So under our current agreement with North Dakota, this is what it takes to fund it.
And when is that agreement up for renegotiation?
We can renegotiate any moment we would like.
So if you were not going to get $15 million, would that mean you'd have to renegotiate?
It would.
And if you got significantly less than $15 million? I know I'm on a repetitive series of questions here, but I'm extremely serious about it. If you got less than $15 million, would you then renegotiate this?
Mr. Chairman, it would behoove us to talk with North Dakota and say, look, we don't have the money to pay you for the next 2 years under the current arrangement, so we need to change the arrangement.
You may want to prepare for that.
Mr. Chairman, we talked a bit about Indian scholarships, so I won't repeat that. This is the students with deferred action status. The deferred action status is a new status the Department of Homeland Security is providing for undocumented students who have been in the U.S. Since they were children. And the governor's recommendation is to provide state grants and other state financial aid to those students. This assumes about 750 students each year would be newly eligible. On reciprocity, I'm going to go to slide 24, and I apologize in advance for a lot of numbers on this slide. I'm just going to really emphasize rows 9 and 10 there at the bottom, but I wanted to include the detail in case people wanted to know exactly how it worked. The governor's recommendation, there is a shortfall of $2.38 million needed for fiscal year 13, and the governor has included that as a recommendation to be paid out of fiscal year 14.
Ms. Grimes, how did that shortfall occur? What happened that we had a shortfall and we didn't anticipate it?
Mr. Chairman, basically two things. The number of Minnesota students attending in North Dakota increased. I'm sorry, three things. The number of North Dakota students attending in Minnesota decreased. And the state of North Dakota started increasing what it appropriates to its post-secondary institutions. And our formula for paying them is based on 64% of their cost. And so when their cost goes up, our obligation goes up. Please keep in mind that The Minnesota has about 65,000 high school graduates a year, and North Dakota has 7,200. So it's not likely that there will ever be an even match in the number of students flowing each way. But the next slides do look more at the flow across the borders.
And Ms. Graham, North Dakota has a surplus too, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I have heard that reported, yes.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That brings up an interesting point. So if North Dakota is increasing their spending, and so that's going to cost us more because the way they're doing their calculation, if we raise this 80-80-80 across the board, how is that going to affect some of our reciprocity agreements with other states and some of those funds moving back and forth?
Ms. Grimes, or who do you want to have come up?
They're separate agreements.
Director Pogue-Miller?
Mr. Chairman, they are separate agreements, and Wisconsin pays us currently, although that number is starting to drop. And North Dakota, we pay them because we have so, in both instances, we have more students from Minnesota going to the other state, in both instances. But the tuitions at Wisconsin and Minnesota are a lot closer together, so the payment between the two states is smaller, and it's a payment to Minnesota rather than us to them. In North Dakota, we have the opposite. We have many, many more students going to North Dakota than to Minnesota, than North Dakota students coming here. And their cost structure or their price is significantly lower than the Minnesota price. And so when you do the calculations, it seems inverse, but as they increase their price, it increases the amount of money we need to send to them to pay for our students going across the border.
Representative Swazinski.
Mr. Chair, so I'm guessing the same would go, looking at that same map on 24, it almost looks like we've got twice as many Minnesota students going to South Dakota as they do to us. Would that, how does that relation work, obviously, because North Dakota probably spends a little bit more per student?
Director Pogue-Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's no payment between the two states
there's
in that
none
instance.
There. Okay.
In that
okay.
instance.
All
right.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, I just might note that one of the fundamental principles of tuition reciprocity is that students should not have a financial incentive to leave their home state to go to school. And so the Minnesota students going to school in North Dakota are paying the same rate they would pay to attend a similar public institution in Minnesota, which is higher than the tuition that North Dakota students already pay. And that actually, that additional tuition students pay actually helps buy down somewhat the price of the money that exchanges between states. This slide, 25, shows the number of students flowing each way across these borders. And as Director Pogue-Miller said, our agreement with South Dakota does not call for an exchange of money, nor does our agreement with a couple of institutions in Iowa, the Iowa Lakes Community Colleges and Twin West Community and Technical College in Minnesota. The same kind of thing for the few who go back and forth across the border to Manitoba. We do have a tuition reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin, and as you can see, we are currently expecting them to pay Minnesota $7.2 million as part of that tuition reciprocity agreement. However, the payment for tuition reciprocity, the outgoing payment to North Dakota comes out of the Office of Higher Education's budget, but the incoming payment from Wisconsin goes to the general fund. It does not come to the Office of Higher Education.
All right, slowly on that one. Let's make a distinction here between general fund and the higher education fund. This committee will be very interested in the higher education target number and that fund. So how does that apply to all of these? What are general fund and what are higher education fund?
Mr. Chairman, the payment, the $6.4 million there shown is the payment from Minnesota to North Dakota. All of that is general fund money that comes out of the Office of Higher Education's appropriation. The payment, the $7.2 million from Wisconsin, all of that is money that goes straight into the general fund. It does not come into the Office of Higher Education. Did that answer your question?
Well, what are we going to be responsible for in our target? If it comes out of your office, do we have to backfill it with our target?
Mr. Chairman, the payments to North Dakota are the ones that come out of our target.
And that's the $15 million, give or take. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, then does that come out of the state grant fund, or do you have a separate fund to take care of this?
Director Pogue-Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is a separate appropriation, so it does not come out of the state grant. There have, Mr. Chairman.
Director Pogamilli.
I think some of the members are aware that at times, to fulfill our obligations to other states, we have taken, under our transfer of authority within the office, money from the state grant to pay for tuition reciprocity. The governor is fully funding this, so that will not happen.
And Director Pogamilli, I think we alluded to that when you gave your presentation, too, and it's a good reminder to us that we have used that grant for flexibility reasons.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, members, obviously that's what I argued to the governor. I said, if you don't fully fund this, the money will come out of the state grant program.
So, Mr. Chairman, this current slide is sort of a one-year slide. Then we've got one slide in there twice. I apologize. If you go ahead to slide 26, 27, that shows you what it is on a biennial basis currently for the current biennium, and then slide 28 shows you what flows to North Dakota and Wisconsin are for the projected to be for the next biennium.
And Mr. Chairman,
Director Pogamilli,
on your previous question, we are starting to look at whether we could change the agreement with North Dakota to somehow change these numbers. Our first impression is that even if we made this the same as the Wisconsin agreement, the numbers would not change that much. But we're looking at that. We will look at that, obviously, because we obviously want to have an agreement that we are willing to pay for as a state. And the overall policy argument, Mr. Chairman, is that big picture, to the extent that we allow students to become reciprocity students and choose the institution that best fits their needs, the overall policy argument is that it is less expensive for Minnesota if 10,000 students choose to go to another state than if we had to pay for those 10,000 students in Minnesota. At some point, that's no longer true, but that's the general understanding of allowing tuition reciprocity. It's better for the student, and in some sense, if you're a state that's exporting students, it's less expensive for you as a state.
And Director Pogamilli, I've said this before, but I'll repeat it again. We have been in the process here of rank ordering need, and the needs that are the greatest are the ones that we are obligated to fund. So I wish you would keep that in mind, too. Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, this is a question for you, I think. To me, it makes no sense that the reciprocity from Wisconsin goes to the general fund and then the money that goes to North Dakota comes out of this office. Is there a possibility in your bill that you would have some language to correct that?
Anything's possible, and I'm sure with the director here, considering he wished it wouldn't come out of his office, I would be amazed if there wasn't a supplemental request at some point. But Director Pogamilli might wish to answer that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did discuss within the administration the idea of having a special revenue fund. And at this point, there has not been a proposal set forth from the executive branch to have a special revenue fund, which basically would say reciprocity money is all within itself, and so the Wisconsin payment would pay for the North Dakota payment, basically. But it has been discussed over the years. I believe there's been bills over the years. And at this moment, at least, there's not a recommendation to do that.
I think, Representative Nornes, your point's well taken. I think our budget's going to be pretty tight, but general revenue would be a much better source, I think, than tapping the grant fund.
Mr. Chair, I'd say your budget is still better than mine was.
Representative Nornes, almost anything would be better than what you had, and will be significantly better, but it won't be as good as the governor's. Director Pogamilli or Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chairman, slide 28 is a little bit about the SLED system. We have a whole set of slides about SLEDs that we're hoping to be able to share with you at some point. It would be an increase of $882,000 each year, $1.764 million for the biennium. It would allow SLEDs to continue and expand. And again, SLEDs allows access to longitudinal data across state agencies and educational institutions that can be used to answer policy questions and to measure educational and workforce outcomes.
And Mr. Chairman,
Director Pogamilli,
to clarify, $1.1 million of that $1.7 is to basically is a transfer payment that you would give to OE, and then we would forward to the minute, to the for the black box behind the scene that is captured the data, the technology that captures the data between the various agencies.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to run through these real quickly just so that you can see that there's information here on the programs that receive level funding, no increased state work study, post-secondary child care grants, very small safety officer survivor grants, a little program called Summer Transition to College. We also administer the Minnesota GI Bill program. The appropriation actually goes to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and through an interagency agreement, they have us operate the program. We also have some programs called Intervention for College Attendance Program, Student Parent Information, our Get Ready Outreach, and then the agency administration is level funded at $2.491 million each year, $4.982 million for the biennium. Then we have a set of four items here that are flow-through funding, the Minitex and MinLink Library Technology Programs, the Midwest Higher Education Compact, United Family Practice Training for Physician Residencies, and the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. Also in House File 437, there is language. All of the pieces of language mentioned on this slide have to do with making the deferred action students eligible for state aid. We are not asking for increased appropriations for anything but the state grant, because post-secondary child care grants, American Indian Scholarship, state and state work study are all what's called campus-based programs, where there's a fixed appropriation that's apportioned out to the campuses. And so the deferred action students would slightly increase the pool of eligible students on each campus, but there would not necessarily have to be an increase in funding. And then Section 8 in Article 2 would repeal a rule that we currently have that says that state student aid recipients must be U.S. citizens or permanent residents. The other changes in House File 437 include the language to change the state grant student share. There is also language that would increase the awards for post-secondary child care grants. This could be done with no increase in the appropriation, because we are not currently spending the full amount appropriated for post-secondary child care grants. And then there is language on transfer of funds amongst the financial aid programs. This is the kind of language that was used to transfer money from the state grant program to the tuition reciprocity program. It's been in a rider underneath the appropriations for many years, and it was thought it might be a good time to move it into statute, since it's been pretty much the same language for a very long time.
Representative Swazinski.
Chair Pawlowski, just kind of moving back to page 33, looking at that Section 8, repeal of the OAH rules, talks about repealing they must be also permanent residents. So maybe you could clarify a bit. So I believe current law, I think, is you have to be a permanent resident for a year in order to qualify. If that is stripped away, do we even need reciprocity? Son of a gun, that's a tough word for me today. But do we even need those agreements? Because couldn't you just move here and say, well, I guess you don't have any residency requirements, so you just get resident Minnesota resident tuition. So,
Ms. Grimes,
to be a resident of Minnesota for the purposes of state financial aid, generally the principle is if you graduate from high school here and you don't actively go and establish residency in another state, you're a resident. And that if you go to another state just to go to college, that you're still a Minnesota resident. People who move here need to live here for a year without going to school more than half time, and before they become residents. So the deferred action students would still have to live in Minnesota for 12 months without going to school for more than half time in order to be eligible as Minnesota resident, just the way the other students who are not deferred action students do. Same requirement.
Okay.
All right. We're going to have you back for any final comments on this, and then for the policy bill. Members, House File 983 is the governor's policy bill. It's the agency bill, and we'll cover that on Wednesday. I also want to remind members, and this is looking ahead, we have booked Friday, April 5th at 10 a.m. as a tentative date to complete our work on the finance bill. If we do not complete it on the Wednesday before, but just in case it takes a little longer, we've booked it. We have to be, the schedule has us now in Ways and Means on that following Monday. I'm sorry, Tuesday. This is April 5th. It's on the back of your agenda. April 5th at 10, we've tentatively booked. That's a Friday, 10 o'clock in the morning. And then we have to be in Ways and Means on Tuesday of the next week. So that's why we booked this just in case. Representative Dorholt.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes for March 13th.
Representative Dorholt moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Any other questions? Seeing none. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.